BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 149, and today is Tuesday, May 22nd, 2012. Yesterday on the podcast, yesterday was a mess. It was an extremely busy day. I recorded the podcast about on time, you know, give or take a little bit. Nothing really is on time in my life, but anyway, I mostly recorded the podcast on time, and then just a series of constant daily events that were going on. Every time I'd start to edit it, I'll give a little insight. Let's on an average podcast, I can expect to spend now on and off with notes. I interrupted myself there, but on and off with notes. Notes for a podcast can take anywhere from a half an hour to put together, up to 3 or 4 or 5 hours, according to what the topic is, how much I already know about the topic, how much documentation I need, or something like the other day when I had to research a word out to really find out what its origin was and what its root meaning, where it came from, that kind of thing. Stuff like that can take a long time to research out, but typically my notes take about a half an hour, 45 minutes to really put them together, and then it takes about an hour and a half to actually record the podcast. That's typically because there seem like there's always interruptions or there's something going on that interrupts the recording. So the recording takes about an hour and a half, and then it takes about 2 hours to edit it because I go back through and I take out the interruptions, things that pop in, and cats batting at the microphone or all the different things that take place. But yesterday was a little different. We have had a long-term house guest that we've really appreciated having her here. She's been a wonderful house guest, and she is a friend of Kai's, and she had was in between jobs, and we were able to help her out a little bit. And she's moving over to Indianapolis to pursue some opportunities over there. So she was in the process of moving out yesterday. Kai is just getting back from a long trip to Texas where she visited friends and had a little break from everything down there. And so Kai is trying to get settled back in up here. And in the meantime, I'm talking with the people that are going to be redoing the BadQuaker.com website. So I was doing some work for that, getting some pictures together. I had to go dig out an old computer that we had used earlier on in the podcast, and I had to get some files off of it. And I had to, first off, I had to set the computer up to even get it to where it was functional again because it's been shoved away now for a while. Anyway, these are all excuses, I suppose. But yeah, yesterday's podcast should have been ready about 10 or 11, maybe 12 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't done until something like, 8 or 9, 10, something like that last night when I finally published it. So I apologize for that. It was just a very long, busy day with constant interruptions. So I guess what I started to get at originally in that little apology was that often, a regular podcast, you've got like a half an hour to prepare the notes. You've got an hour and a half to actually do the podcast and like 2 hours to edit it. So you've got like a total of 4 or 5 hours tops invested in a podcast. And that one, was more like on and off. It was more like 14, 16 hours, something like that. Anyway, so hopefully we're back in control now and we can get things back in order here. And speaking of the updates on the website, I said this yesterday, but I want to reemphasize it today. If you have input on what you'd like to see on the badquaker.com website, be sure and email that to me. You can send that to me personally at Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com. And be sure and spell it bad Quaker, not bad quacker. We've had some email that's got lost because of that. Q-U-A-K-E-R is very easily confused with the word quacker. But Ben, B-E-N, at bad Quaker, BadQuaker.com. Okay, anyway, any feedback that you have, anything you'd like to see on the website, any changes you'd like to see, be sure and shoot those to me. We're in the process. The guys are working on the website as we speak, as they say. Well, maybe not this early. They're actually out in Colorado, and I'm in Ohio, so they may not be up yet. It's still a little bit early for them. But they are working on the website. They're working on a new logo for it. They're working on a new intro page. There's just it's really looking pretty cool what they're working on. So if you have things that you'd like to see at the on the website, if you have stuff, you know, if there's any interest in things like a forum, or if there's you know, we were talking about a video page, if you know, if you have input on any of that stuff, be sure and send it to me, Ben at badquaker.com. Okay, and I should mention that you know, these guys, they're kind enough to do this work for us on the website, and when it's all said and done, I'm going to give them some advertising on there. But they're doing this purely to promote the cause of liberty. It's you know, this is literally thousands of dollars of work that's going to be done on the badquaker.com website. And they are doing it for the cause of liberty. We're not going to have to, you know, cough out the normal big amounts of money that people would have to do to get this kind of work done. So we're really just thrilled to have them working on the project. There'll be more about that in coming podcasts. Now some criticism from the Reddit folks over there. We post on Reddit now and then when we have a podcast that is particularly stands out, or we have a YouTube video or something like that. We try to link to it over at Reddit. Now the Austrian economics section of Reddit have made it clear to us that they don't want our input. So that's fine. Whatever. They can just have their own little private party over there all they want. But we have faced, you know, pretty good open arms from the communities at Reddit that are like the libertarian community, the agorism community, the anarcho-capitalist community, market anarchist, excuse me, at Reddit. We've had, you know, pretty good responses from them. The last podcast that I did, I guess that was yesterday's. That was the last podcast I did that was talking about the Greenbacker video with the little girl who's giving the speech about Greenbacker trying to push socialism. The agorist folks have labeled that as controversial, and it was downvoted. And, you know, I'm not upset by that. I'm more concerned. I suppose it is controversial when you point out that somebody's using a child like that. Some people are going to be offended by that. So I hope the folks at Reddit Agorism can actually listen to the podcast and realize that what I'm trying to provide is a different solution other than the Greenbacker socialism, which actually is agorism. You know, the underground and free markets, and, you know, maybe because I took a shot at the, well, I don't know. Anyway, I hope I'm not trying to be controversial at Reddit. So, you know, if I offend the folks in the agorism, it's not intentional at all. But we did have some positive feedback. I think it was from the libertarian section at Reddit that we're going to try to incorporate into the website, where there's not really a good description of what the podcast is about. So even if somebody finds the website or finds a reference at Reddit, they get to the website and they don't really, it's not obvious what the theme of the podcast is. So a lot of people are not going to want to immediately commit themselves to a download in an hour listening to a podcast if they don't really know what it's about. So I do appreciate the feedback coming from the Reddit libertarian community there on that one. Okay, as far as some of the other sections of Reddit, this is just a good time. There's some nuts over there. I mean, there's some people who just live to fight, and I don't have any real, I don't have any desire to be around people like that. People who just want to be on the internet so that they can. It's like that Monty Python skit where the guy comes walking into the office and he says, I'm here for an argument. And these guys are like, no, you're not. Well, yes, I am. No, you're not. And it's like, well, you're not really making an argument. You're just contradicting me. No, I'm not. You know, I find no value in that. That's an aspect of the internet that I find irritating and completely without value. People who get on the internet just for the sheer thrill of arguing with other people. I find that childish and annoying. But anyway, I did want to also mention, I suppose this intro is kind of stretching out a little bit, but I did also want to mention an aspect of the kind of the way we do things here at badquaker.com and part of our emphasis, why we do our podcast the way we do and so forth. I don't really... Well, like, for instance, I talked about the NATO summits yesterday. I talked about the NATO summit yesterday, and I talked a little bit about the Occupy folks. And, you know, my point in that was not to bring up news and not to sensationalize an event that's currently going on. But my point in bringing that up was to see, you know, to examine what the root situation is there, what causes the problem, and what solutions can be offered. And in the case of the Occupy protesters in their interactions with the police and coming out on the streets and protesting and all this, I wanted to emphasize that there may be aspects of that. You could argue that there are aspects of that that produce a good, a positive result. But ultimately, when you do this, you are basically taking on the state on the battlefield that the state chooses, using weapons the state is very comfortable with, and you're fighting the state at the exact time that the state wants you to fight them. So, you know, in that sense, I really have to question the ultimate profitability of using that means to resist the state. And again, let's go back to agorism. I think that's really the answer. I think the answer is not in going out and making a public display. Now, that's not to say that the public display is not useful. Every time that the Occupy people, and there's a lot of them, I said this yesterday, we can't just say that they're just dirty hippies or they're communists or they're a bunch of socialists. There's a really wide variety of people that are out there protesting the NATO summits. It's not really even just the Occupy people. There are a lot of people, there are right-wing people who are consistent with what they've been saying for years that hate NATO because NATO really goes against conservative principles if you really think it through. And if you think about what people like Newt Gingrich was saying in the 90s about Bill Clinton's use of NATO, and you go back to what conservatives were saying in the 90s about Bill Clinton and his use of NATO. And I separate that, the conservatives, to guys like Newt Gingrich, because Newt is, you know, a conservative in name only. But either way, the consistent conservative really should understand the horrible dangers of NATO and being involved in such a thing. So there's solid reasons for a lot of people to object to these NATO summit and to this NATO summit and want to go out there and resist it. On the other hand, like I was pointing out yesterday, as you do this, there's a positive thing and there's a negative thing, and it's all according to how you look at it, I suppose. But the positive thing is you draw a lot of attention to how bad the police state problem is right now. And you also make the police state worse, because those cops in Chicago who already tend toward violence, Chicago has some of the worst cops in the world, and already they tend towards violence, and then you give them the opportunity to go out and really enjoy having a good time beating up hippies. I mean, that's the way they look at it. They look at it as, not all of them, but a good portion of those Chicago cops just live for opportunities like this. So however mean and violent and nasty that cop was 6 months ago, 6 months from now, after having tasted the blood of these riot or of these demonstrations, rather, turning them into riots, that's what the cops are doing. But anyway, having tasted the blood of these demonstrations, that same cop is going to be far crueler in 6 months from now than he was 6 months ago, because he's already got the taste of it. He's gotten away with beating up people, with busting some heads. And the cops that were on the edge, that weren't really so bad, once they experience that, and they get this way of thinking in their mind, like they're saving the day by going out there beating up those protesters. They really believe in their mind that they're doing good, they're saving civilization by busting up these protests. And as they convince themselves in their mind of that, they justify more and more violence against the citizenry. And so by actually having these protests, you teach the cops to be worse, to be meaner. And then you have more and more violence coming from that end of the spectrum. And so there's a good and a bad to this. The good is that this will expose the state more and more for what the real nature of the state is. The bad part is, we get a meaner state, and we have to live with that and tolerate it. Well, one might make the argument, and actually this has been my argument at times, one might make the argument that it's better to let's go ahead and expose the state for being as cruel as it can possibly be, and let's get this over with. Let's yank the Band-Aid off. Let's jump in the pool. Let's get this over with and really expose the state for what it is. Let's call the state's bluff. I don't know how many more of these metaphors I can make up on the spot here, but let's really pull the mask off and show what the state is. And how are we going to do that? You walk up and you just poke that dragon right straight in the nose and then watch him freak out. And then people can see what an evil beast it really is. The problem is, whoever the guy is who goes up and pokes the dragon in the nose is getting barbecued. So that's the problem with the protests. Yeah, we get to see the state for more of its evil. But on the other hand, as the state displays its evil, there are human beings getting their skulls cracked open. There are people having their noses broken. There are people that are losing vision because, cops have jammed their thumbs into their eyes. Or in the case of the one lady in Los Angeles, the cop shoots her at point blank with a high pressure can of mace that is supposed to shoot at long distance, and he literally blows her eye socket apart and hits her from one side, blows one eye socket completely apart, destroys that eye, hits her face hard enough that it actually destroyed her other eyeball as well. So now she's blind because a cop decided to spray her in the eyes with mace at a point-blank range. Well, this kind of thing, as we start to see it, of course it exposes the state as more and more to more and more people to see how cruel the state can really be and what kind of a police state that we really live in. But yet at the same time, people lose their eyesight. People get their heads busted open. That poor homeless guy out in California that the cops just took turns beating him until they beat him to death. This exposes the state. And he's dead. So you have to weigh this out. There are ways that we can expose the state without getting ourselves beat up and killed. And so I prefer those methods. I don't say people shouldn't go out and march and people shouldn't go out and protest. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that that method is a method that ultimately is going to be defeated, because if you face an enemy on the battlefield of his choice with the weapons of his choice at the time of his choosing, you lose. And that's what protesting on the streets produces. And again, to just harp on the same thing, that's the secret of agorism. That's why underground markets, I'm not talking about black markets like drugs and stuff. I'm talking about underground labor markets, underground markets in precious metals, underground markets in alternative currencies of every kind, Bitcoin, anything else that people can use to eliminate the paying of taxes and the eliminate the eyes of the government poking into everything that you're doing. As you do these things, you not only strengthen yourself financially, you pull finances out of the state's grasp, out of the entire system. And when I'm talking about the state, I'm talking about more than just the government. I'm talking about the giant corporations. I'm talking about the banks. I'm talking about the mainstream media. As you pull more and more of the market into the underground market worldwide and out from underneath or out of the clutches of this beast, then more and more of the market is free because it's invisible to that beast. So you don't necessarily have to go up and poke the dragon in the nose. If you can just very, very slowly and carefully steal all his wealth, it's not necessary to wake him up. And then once he does figure out that all his wealth has been taken and all his power is gone, then when he wakes up and thrashes around, he's going to take out the ones closest to him. That's those people who support the state. That's my ultimate metaphor there for the state, is that dragon, that beast in his cave, and we sit and slowly and carefully rob him until he has nothing left. And then when he finally realizes, he's going to thrash out at the ones closest to him, and those are the people who support the state, and we're not at a loss by... You know, if the state is busting the heads of the people who support the state, yay, we win. So, you know, there's not a downside to that to us. And that's my belief. That's what I think will happen. I think ultimately, as we pull the market out from underneath the state, once the state realizes that it's going to be too late, and the state will have no choice but to strike out against the very people that support it. And I've talked before about how the Nazis turned on their own officers and started just, you know, murdering their own officers right and left as they began to deteriorate. And I believe that's what the state will do. It will turn on its strongest supporters in the end as it lashes out. Okay, so I have completely abandoned my notes and just off rambling again. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you're like, that's what you always do. But anyway, I'll see if I can get back to the topic here. I did want to read something today that I read in yesterday's podcast. I want to just reemphasize it because I really believe it's important. And that's the words of Bastiat. This simple little line from Bastiat. When law and morality contradict each other, the citizen has the cruel alternative of either losing his moral sense or losing his respect for law. And of course, what Bastiat is referring to is what I said yesterday, that as man makes more and more and more layers of nonsensical laws, then you're presented with this contradiction, where you realize that all these laws are goofy. They're cruel. They're immoral. They're stupid. And so then you begin to lose. And this happens across an entire society. And so society begins to lose respect for all law. If you raise generations of kids, and let's use kids. This is a good example. Let's say you have a young child, and you're trying to teach the child, don't hit your little brother, don't hit your big sister. And so you're trying to teach the child not to hit. And while you're teaching that child not to hit, you decide to hit the child because they peed their pants, let's just say. Well, you're trying to teach the child to use the toilet, to potty train the child, and you're going to hit the child because it doesn't have the control it needs to get to the bathroom properly. when you're trying to teach your child to, you know, you're trying to potty train your child and you want to give positive reinforcement and you want to cheer them on and you know, yay, look at this, you made it to the toilet and this is how we do this and you got on the potty, good, that's good, you know, and you use positive reinforcement to potty train the child so that it learns the bladder control and it learns the urges and it can and it knows what to do about those urges before it becomes too late, before it, you know, before the little guy wets his pants. And so as you teach the child, don't hit your brother and don't hit your sister, you're hitting them because they peed their pants, even though they have no control over peeing their pants. Well, what you're doing when you do that is you undermine your own authority as a parent. And you teach your child a lack of respect for your authority and for your words. So why should they believe that it's wrong to hit their little brother or hit their big sister when you're hitting them over something that they have no control over? You see, so you're teaching the child a contradiction. You're teaching the child to do two things. First off, disrespect the parent and everything the parent stands for. And you're teaching the child that violence is the method to get what you want. So you shouldn't be surprised when your little kid starts beating up other kids. And this is the same. It works on with a toddler, and it works with an entire society. You're teaching your children. We all try to teach our children, don't steal. Don't steal. Don't use violence. Don't hit kids. Don't use violence to get what you want. Don't be a bully. Don't shove other kids around. Don't tattle on kids. Nobody likes a tattletale. We teach our kids these things. And then what do we do in real life? How do we handle the state? Well, the state is based on beating people up and stealing from them. That's what the state does. They come through every year where I live here in Western Ohio. They come through not just every year, sometimes every 6 months they'll come through with a new school levy. We have to have a school levy. We have to have a school levy right now or else the kids are not good. We're going to shut down the bus service for the local public schools if we don't get a school levy through. We're going to lay off all the janitors if we don't get a school levy through. The topic never comes up, oh, we're going to cut the supervisory staff by 20%. That they never go in that direction. They always want to cut the bus drivers or cut the janitorial staff or they threaten to cut out the part of the football. You know, that's when they really start getting desperate. They're like, well, we're going to have to start cutting down on football. And then all the citizenry starts shelling out the big bucks because you can't touch the holy football. But anyway, my point in that is what you have when a group of parents in a city like where I live here in Springboro, Ohio, when a group of parents don't want to have to provide transportation for their children. They want the bus to come around and pick up their kids. They don't want to have to drive their kids out to the giant centralized government school that took massive amounts of money to build just outside of town. They don't want to do that. They want the bus to come around and pick up their kids for them so that they can go ahead and, you know, stop by at the Starbucks on their way to work and not have their schedule interrupted. So in order to have their way, they're going to organize a bunch of parents to get around and get the vote out and use all kinds of methods to get people to vote in the new school levy. And yet, where I sit in my house right now, in the room that I'm sitting in, I have neighbors on two sides of me that are both elderly retired ladies and on fixed incomes. And both of them have no children, have never had children. And the levies are going to hit them, and they're going to have to pay for those yuppies on the other side of town who don't want to drive their kids to the government school. They want the government buses to come pick up their kids and haul them to the government school so that they can have time to stop by and have their latte on the way to work. So that is theft. You're stealing from these elderly retired ladies who have no children so that you on the other side of town in your $1 million home can get in your Lexus and drive to work without having to worry about getting your kids to school. That's theft. When we do this in front of our kids, we are setting the example that theft is the way you get things done. And as a society adopts this generation after generation, then things like violence and theft and lies, The children are raised understanding that this is right, this is good, this is how society functions, because that's how government functions. And so we learn from the youngest ages that two things. You say life is one way, but then you live it the other way. You talk about the golden rule, and then you rob your neighbor so that you can have free bus service for your kids to go to a government school. I'm stealing a quote from a Facebook friend that goes by the name of the Libertarian Homeschooler, and they put a quote from Leo Tolstoy on their Facebook account, and I'm going to read that. It says, "Not only does the action of governments not deter men from crimes, on the contrary, it increases crime by always disturbing and lowering the moral standard of society. Nor can this be otherwise, since always and everywhere a government, by its very nature, must put in the place of the highest eternal religious law, not written in books but in the hearts of men and binding on everyone, its own unjust man-made laws, the object of which is neither justice nor the common good, but of which is neither justice nor the common good of all, but various considerations of home and foreign expediency." Now, translating that from Russian to English maybe makes it a little bit confusing, but that's what Tolstoy is talking about right there, what I just described. This generational process of teaching children to be immoral adults, and then teaching them that that's good and that's the way, that's how it's supposed to be. I've way overrun here. I'm supposed to break for my commercial, and I've way overrun it. So stick with me for 2 minutes. I'll be right back, and we'll finish off the other half of the podcast. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Well, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. On the second half of the podcast, I'd like to go back to the question that I presented yesterday on the podcast. I'm hearing, you know, just hints and nothing really solid of problems in the libertarian community with Gary North. And I can't actually find anybody articulating what the problem with him is, other than just vague references that, you know, oh, we don't like him or whatever. So, again, I want to ask anybody who knows where the Gary North hate is coming from. Please, I'm not asking so that I can attack anybody or refute them or defend Gary North or attack Gary North or anything else. I really just like to know what the source of that is, because I think something might have got past me. I don't know. You know, if he said something in public that's a problem, or if he's done something, or I'd really like to know what the issue is or what it's based on. Just drop me an email, ben@badquaker.com, if you know anything at all about what the source of this Gary North hate is about. Because, again, I'm very curious. Aha! That's my phone, but I'll get to that. So I'm very curious as to what this is about Gary North, and if you can fill me in on it, if you know any of the details, please do so. I'd really like to research that a little bit. In the meantime, I want to read an outtake of one of his articles that he published recently, because I've seen lately quite a few people talking about, well, you know, America is just like Rome, we're falling just like Rome, and America, and these things usually are based on some kind of idea that Rome fell because of greed or because of moral corruption or because of these different things, and this is just not so. You know, Rome lasted about 1,000 years. It took about 700 years for it to rise to power, and it took about 300 years for it to fall. And when Rome was only, you know, 100 years old, 200 years old, 50 years old, it was pretty corrupt. It was, you know, it was morally speaking, from the same people who will tell you that Rome fell because of its morals, if you actually sit down and explain to them how Roman society functioned within the first 100 years of its existence, when it was still a republic, and before it ever expanded out to become an empire, well, it was still just a strong local city-state. If you really sit down and explain how Roman society functioned to these same people that want to tell you that Rome fell because of its morals or corruption or greed or something, they would be appalled at how Roman life was on a casual basis. You know, 200, 300 BC, Rome, from Western Christian point of view, was a horribly evil, corrupt place 300-400 BC. So, you know, so when somebody, especially if it's coming from a Christian point of view or a Western point of view, where the people who think, you know, well, I don't want to get into details and wrap up all my time talking on this. I'm just going to say that historically speaking, if you apply modern Christian Western ethics and morals and all these things to Rome and say that that's why Rome fell, then Rome never should have gotten big enough to even have a wall around it. It would have fallen before, you know, within the first couple generations of its existence. So that entire argument is not based on history. It's based on Christian myth. That's all that is. Okay, now, that's all that to the side. The reason Rome fell is for economic reasons. And Gary North in this article goes into some detail, and he talks about how many different theories there are in the fall of Rome and all that. But I'm not going to read that part to you. I just want to blaze through this part so I can get to my point here. So this is from the Lou Rockwell article, and I'll put a link to it on the page on badquaker.com where this podcast appears. But there's a law of bureaucracy that applies to empire. At some point, it costs more to administer the bureaucracy than the bureaucracy can generate through coercion. Then the empire begins to crack. It cannot enforce its claims. So the growth of empire has economics at its center, economics of scale. The fall of empire also has economics at its center, economics of scale. I think this process is an application of the law of increasing returns. In the initial phase of the process, adding more of one factor increases total output. But as more of it is added, another law takes over, the law of decreasing returns. An example, water and land. Add some water to a desert and you can grow more food. Add more water and you can grow a lot more food. there's an accelerating rate of returns. The joint output is of greater value than the cost of adding water. But if you keep adding water, you will get a swamp. The law of decelerating returns takes over. Add more water and the land is underwater. You might as well have a desert. This law applies to power. Add power and you generate more income. But if you keep adding power, expenses of the bureaucracy will begin to eat up the revenues. Resistance will also increase internal and external. The system either implodes or withers away. Now, I really appreciate that argument from Gary North. I think he's dead on. And this is why Rome fell, is because its bureaucracy had gotten so bloated that the mechanisms of state were consuming more than the productive class could produce. And it's not just the mechanisms of state. Anybody who studies Rome very much knows that Rome basically developed a welfare class within the city of Rome so that literally masses of people could simply go down to the main area of town, get free bread provided to them by the government and free entertainment. And the government continued to appease this population of essentially of welfare recipients with more and more free bread and more free entertainment as the outlying parts of the empire were taxed heavier and heavier. So you've got two things acting on the empire at the same time. You have this interior welfare society feeding off of the productive class, and you have this bureaucracy group that's feeding off of the productive class. And as these two groups swell bigger and bigger, typically, not only in Rome, but typically what you see is at some point in time, the bureaucracy class will turn on the welfare class. To a large extent, the bureaucracy class uses the welfare class to stay in power. But at some point in time, the welfare class, you know, if you start, I'm thinking of, who was that? Some famous celebrity, I think it was somebody on either the Food Network channel or on the Travel Channel that went to Haiti with the silly notion that they could just start handing out some food. And what ended up happening was they basically created a food riot as the, you know, you start giving away food, free food among a lot of poor people, and you just get mobbed and you get violence and you get just people acting crazy. And so, and that happened in Haiti when these people tried to do that. Well, that's, don't be so naive. But that's exactly what happens on an empire level, too. The welfare class becomes, they want more and more and more. Once you start giving out free stuff, you know, once a government starts handing out free stuff, you've started down a path that you can't back up from. There, it's an endless, it's, welfare is like an endless hole that you can't shove enough food and enough money down to satisfy it. And as that welfare class grows, the bureaucracy of the welfare class grows. If you think about how many bureaucrats it takes just to manage the welfare systems of the United States, and the same way with like the Social Security Administration and the Veterans Administration and all these massive bureaucracies, if you figure out how many people have to be employed to do all that work, then you have this unbelievable growth in the actual people receiving the handouts and the people handing out the handouts. And this becomes unsustainable at some point. The bureaucrats, the bureaucratic class becomes so big that the actual productive class can no longer support them and the poor. And so the bureaucratic class then begins to turn on, it can only turn on the working class so much because that's where the bread and butter is coming from. So it ends up turning on the poor class. And then you end up with, you know, people being rounded up in ghettos and things like this. Now, this is not wild-eyed, tinfoil hat, conspiracy theory stuff. This is just taking something and working it out to its obvious, logical end. Okay, I got ganged up on there. Had to pause the recording. I had the animal conspiracy got me from every direction there. Nikki, the shy little dog, had to go outside, and Baggy, the dominant cat who owns the universe, wanted food, and we had squirrels at the door demanding food, and blue jays coming up to the window and giving me the look. So I'd rather feed the blue jays a peanut or two and have them leave my cherry trees alone. So, trying to get back to, and I was rushing around in a hurry trying to get all that done so I could get back here and podcast back to you again, and now I'm out of breath. Anyway, getting back to what Gary North was talking about there, basically that's how an empire falls. It doesn't fall because people are taking bribes or because there's, you know, it's it's too much to the left or too much to the right or too much, all of those things, the argument of it's the morality of the people or it's greed or it's, all of those things are beside the point. The point is that every manifestation of the state has natural limitations built into it. And this includes manifestations of the state that we don't normally think of. Specifically, I'm thinking of corporations. Corporations are a product of the state. They were invented by the state, and they're propped up by the state. Now, that doesn't mean business. If there was no state, you could have, potentially, you could have some fairly large businesses. But there are limitations of scale, and that's what Gary North is talking about here. There are limitations of scale as to how big a business can grow to until its own bureaucracy begins to eat its own profits. So, for example, I was talking to someone in Facebook not too long ago, and I was trying to explain that you don't have to, let's say you believe, because this person did believe this, you believe that certain corporations are evil, and this person was specifically picking on Walmart. You believe Walmart is evil. Okay, so what is the good libertarian to do about this? Well, he was willing to use the power of government to beat up Walmart. That's not libertarian. That's essentially being a statist. That's being exactly like everybody on the left and everybody on the right. To use the power of government to pick winners and losers in the marketplace is the opposite of being a libertarian. So what is the libertarian answer to this? It's to let the market fix the market. Now, that means that doesn't mean leaving the situation like it is, where the government gives all kinds of advantages to Walmart so that Walmart can beat up small competitors and so Walmart can do all these nasty things that people hate Walmart for. What that means is for the government to get out of the way, stop providing advantages to big corporations like Walmart, and allow the market to balance itself out. Now, how would that work in corporations? Well, as a corporation begins to grow, the upper management of that corporation, the bigger the company gets, and let's stop using the word corporation at this point, because we're talking about companies without the advantage of government. The actual corporate status is a status that the government gives to some companies to give them advantages in the marketplace. So let's take that all away, and we only have theoretical companies in a stateless market, the way it should be. Okay, so as a company begins to grow, and even a company like Walmart, where it started out with a single owner in Arkansas and then developed from there, as a company begins to grow, as long as the upper management and ownership of the company, specifically ownership, as long as the ownership of the company stays in touch with two things, the employees and the customers, as long as the ownership of the company remains in touch with the employees and the customers, then the ownership of the company gets direct feedback and can adjust the company to the needs of the customers and the needs of the employees. And so the company has to share enough of its profits with its employees, otherwise the employees will leave. And the company, the ownership of the company, has to provide products and services that meet the needs of the customers, otherwise they'll go to some other supplier. So this direct relationship between the owners of a company and the employees and the customers that has to remain direct. Once you get a company big enough to where the ownership of the company is detached and no longer has a direct interaction with the customers and the employees, then that company has a natural weakness built into it. It doesn't have the direct communication. Therefore, it can't get the kind of market signals from both labor and the customer base to be able to understand how to manage that company efficiently, and it will slowly begin to weaken. And another upcoming company where the management of that company has a better grasp on what the customers want and or what the employees' needs are, that company will steal the employees from the bigger company and steal the customers from the bigger company. And so this economy of scale works in two directions. A larger company has better purchasing power, therefore they can get things at a lower price. But the bigger they get, the less in touch with their customer base and their employee base. So this economy of scale works in two directions and will bring down a big company just like it brings up a small company. And so when the market works by itself without the coercion of government, these things balance themselves out, and there is no giant Walmart or General Electric or IBM that come in and begin to dominate a particular aspect of the market, because the market itself cross-checks these things. So this same thing happened. This is exactly what Gary North is describing with empires. The difference with an empire, of course, is that they have the advantage of owning an army, and they can inflict what they want upon people, whether the customer base, so to speak, whether the customer base likes it or not, and whether the employee base, whether they like it or not, the empire can inflict upon them what it wants. And that's what we have with corporations as well. Due to the advantage of government, a corporation like Walmart or General Electric or General Motors or any of these big companies like this can utilize regulatory blockage and things like this to hold down competitors and to get the advantages they need in order to get the price structure they need and in order to force employees to work at the wages that they want, that the corporation wants. And if you think, well, then a union is the answer. Well, a union is just another aspect of the state. Unions typically are based on aggression. They are based on democracy. Democracy in and of itself is aggression. So, can you have a union without having votes and elections and so forth for union officials? Well, of course not. And the entire idea of a union, the vast majority of unions are required membership to work at a specific company. So if you're required to join something and required to pay dues into it, that's violence. That's not voluntary. And so, again, we go back to having the power. These things exist through the power of the state. It's through the threat of aggression that these things are able to exert their power down upon the workers and upon the customer base. So if you take the state out of the equation, then there becomes no reason for coercive unions. There becomes no way that a coercive union could stay in existence. Voluntary unions could still function without the state. Voluntary unions could still function. But to a large extent, they wouldn't be as necessary, because the other market pressures would force businesses, not only this economy of scale that I was talking about, but other market pressures would force businesses to pay a competitive wage. Otherwise, you just go somewhere else. And so this whole economy worked under a voluntary economy. The market is set free to do these things, whereas any influence of the state produces this problem that Gary North is talking about with the economy of scale, so that when it gets big enough, it is guaranteed to begin to start to consume more to stay alive than what it produces with its own aggression. This is the case with companies like General Motors, who recently were completely head over heels and about to completely collapse, and they had to use the aggression of government and steal from taxpayers to stay in business. And even now, companies like General Motors and others like that who can't stay in business in the marketplace, they can't stay in business without the aggression of the state, even them, even companies like that, they tend to hire small contract companies to do vast amounts of the work for them that they just can't efficiently do. And the reason why that takes place is because of this economy of scale that Gary North was talking about there. Once the corporation gets so big, it becomes inefficient to the point of where it has to contract out some of the most basic things that it's doing. Back in the olden days, back in the like 1920s and even up into the 30s, Ford Motor Company was striving to control every aspect of production for its vehicles, all the way from the old man Henry Ford. The original Henry Ford was a little bit loony, but at the same time, because of the problems he was facing with the government and because of the problems he was facing with other car companies like General Motors, he took it upon himself to finance things like his own coal mines, his own iron production, his own railroads to transport the steel to get it to Detroit so that he could Dearborn so that he could make his Fords, his automobiles. He wanted to control every aspect of production from the time the raw materials came out of the ground until it rolled out onto the highway, owned by a customer. He wanted to control every aspect of production, sales, distribution, everything. And the reason he wanted to do that was because he felt that that was the only way he could really have control of his business. But the problem is, once a business gets to a certain size, that becomes impractical. And that's what happened with Ford. It got to a certain size. It began depending on government contracts. World War II came along, and Ford entirely depended on government contracts. So the necessity of having its own rail lines, Ford's own rail lines, and it's the necessity of having Ford's own coal mines and iron smelting processes and things like this, all of that lost its economic appeal, and it was cheaper to contract it out. And that's directly because of two things. One, the growing dependence of Ford upon government contracts, and the growing size of Ford to the point of where it could no longer function because of economies of scale. It could no longer function on those smaller levels. It had to contract those things out. So that's exactly the thing that Gary North is talking about here with empires, but it also applies to each little aspect of the state, including banks, including corporations, including the news media. You see this today happening in the mainstream media, as mainstream media, rather than actually having reporters go out and research things and search through documents and find things, the mainstream media now is just popping on the internet and pulling up Drudge Report or pulling up, Huffington Report or whatever. And rather than actually having their reporters, really research topics, they're basically letting the smaller people on the internet do the research for them, and then they're just reporting on what's already being reported. Of course, they're filtering it through the mainstream media's propaganda filters, but still, that's what you're getting. You're getting from the mainstream media, you're getting news that's actually been contracted in a sense. The same way I was talking about with Ford Motor Company there, where the news agencies used to go and dig up all their stuff themselves. Now they depend on layers and layers and layers of other people doing that for them. And more they're becoming irrelevant and less necessary. Okay, well, that's all I have time for today. I still didn't get to go to read Mises' story, The Master Builder. Maybe I can get to that next time. In the meantime, be sure and get over to badquaker.com. Send me an email, ben@badquaker.com. Let me know what you think about the website, what you'd like to see, what you'd like to see added, what you'd like to see gone. And for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. And folks, thank you very much for listening. And thank you for a whole year, a little over a year now, of listening to my podcast. Thank you very much.